Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show.
Welcome to episode 137, where we are discussing a 1918 lecture by Max Weber titled Science as a Vocation, delivered in German to the University of Munich and translated by various authors since. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi, this is Rohan calling in from London.
Hi, this is Pedro from Copenhagen.
And welcome. This is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States. And today we're going to do a first, which is to do the same author as we did last month, just a different reading. This is the first time we've ever actually done that. And we're doing it because the author, Max Weber, he has had such an incredible, diverse body of work. And last month when we covered his chapter on bureaucracy, it was sort of a revisit of a work. We decided it was kind of important to take a broader view of him and look at something entirely different to sort of expand his canon a little bit in our program. And what we chose is a lecture that he delivered called Science as a Vocation, which was delivered to an audience at Munich University in 1918, then later published. And the version that I read is kind of a common one. It's Girth and Mills, 1946. It's that translation. And it's a very interesting discussion. I mean, he was basically asked, what does it mean for science to be a vocation? And this whole speech is, it's not a very direct answer. It's not like, is it or isn't it, or what does it mean specifically? It's kind of like I took it as sort of like a problem framing. What does it mean to understand science as a vocation? And what are the implications of that moniker? And so then, you know, here's how we have to think about it.
So yes, that was very interesting text to reread. And I think that maybe we can just start by getting the general topics, right, that he covers. And I think the main divisions that come up is that, especially in the beginning, he looks at the external circumstances, right, the conditions of one has in doing science or being an academic. And I think, of course, we can explore that because it would be interesting to think how has changed or not changed. He's comparing Germany with the US 100 years ago. And then he really delves into the more, let's say, subjective experience, right? The sense of the inner vocation of science, how science at his time was structured, what he sees to be its main values and principles, also its limits. And in a way, and this is, I think, there is a link to something that Tom was hinting at, which is exactly almost this idea of the office of a researcher or a teacher, and what are the limits and expectations that one has in performing such function. So that is my overall, I think, schema on what has been covered, which, as Tom said, is not a direct answer, but is trying to, I think, reflect a lot from his own experience, right? He brings a lot of that in what it means to exercise such work in those conditions and to live such life in that kind of space that Germany was back in the day.
Yeah, for me, this was my first time actually reading this piece. I guess a quick logistical point for listeners to keep in mind as well is I read a different translation, a more recent one by Rodney Livingston and edited by David Owen and Tracy B. Strong, which is from 2004. So if I have some quotes, you might hear some words different based on whatever version you have. There were interesting updates in this newer version. For example, even the word vocation in this version, the author, the editors and translators footnote out saying that Max Weber uses the word vocation to mean both what we would today call vocation and profession. And then what they did in this translation was to just themselves use the word profession when he meant it more in the sense of profession rather than in the sense of vocation. So there are subtle kind of differences that come with a different translation. Anyway, so my experience as a first-time reader of this particular work of Weber was that it was interesting how he tackled the topic. Because it's a lecture, of course, it's not as clear analytically, you know, that section A, section B, but like Pedro was saying, broadly, you can think of it as, you know, first half is external conditions, second half is internal conditions. And I found that pleasantly surprising because I thought he would start immediately at the internal, like when you think vocation today, we think calling and kind of intrinsic motivation and purpose. But he starts off in a very practical way saying that let's look at the system of how the profession works. What are the incentives? What is the promotion system? And he does an interesting kind of Germany-US comparison as well, which I found just historically interesting, if nothing else.
Yeah, thank you. And that was kind of where I wanted to start, too, was about that comparison up front, because it not only kind of sets the tone for the context, you know, the context in which he's writing, but he was also kind of warning that he was already kind of seeing signs that the German system was giving way to a more American system. And I wonder to what extent that has continued. But going with what he said, to kind of summarize the comparison, I took it to mean that in the German system, there was a sense of a lecturer who was your entry-level academic worker, if you will. And the lecturer would be paid based on lecture fees that were collected by those who would be in the audience. Whereas in the American system, the lecturer or the assistant to a full professor is kind of diving headfirst into research and maybe assigned teaching duties, basically is actually going through a bit more of a grindstone where the assistant is paid up front a salary as opposed to just collecting based on what specific lectures he's being provided. The result is that basically they're put through a rite of passage that seems designed to wear them out and figure out whether or not they're going to survive the first year or so. And if they do, then they set themselves on an academic path. Whereas the docent on the German side, the individual is actually fighting to get recognized, is not allowed to do much outside of their area of expertise. They're told what they're going to lecture on, and it's kind of sparse, and they're not paid much. So it's survival mode of a different sort, which I think kind of sets the stage for a discussion of why would people put themselves through this at the beginning of their academic career? What about the calling to science encourages them to go through this probationary phase, if you will?
I mean, nowadays, I think people would say that a lot of what he's describing there is how people that are privileged can have this or can, you know, can go from vocation to a job, right? What he's trying to say, what kind of job it is. And I think, of course, he talks about how the American system is more a bureaucratic one. You have a salary, clear expectations, a career path, versus this one that, I don't know, we may call more like a star system, this sort of sense that is almost like a nobility, right? That you almost have to live as if you don't need the material conditions, right? So, of course, there's a question of who is able to exercise that work in such a way. And of course, it also explores some of the luck elements and the, let's say, relational aspects of who gets, you know, put forward or not and all of that, right? And I think it's interesting to think that still today, some of this still exists in some systems. People usually talk about how for a long time and still today in Germany, there is this more chair model, that even when people are doing PhDs, that you first start as an assistant to the big professor, that, you know, eventually you transition into a PhD position. So I think some of this is a long legacy somehow. And I think that is also important to say here is that it brings the connection between research and teaching, right? Because that's the other thing that it brings in terms of the conditions in the world structured. Is almost, I think, surprising, right? To look back in 100 years on how the work looked like and what teaching research meant and how much people did and how much constraints they had or not. It's very cautionary, I feel, this first part, as one can imagine, including on making people understand what kind of work is this and how, as we know, of course, teaching and research are not necessarily aligned. The people may have a preference for one or the other. They may be great researchers, but not necessarily as enthusiastic and skilled as teachers, and how that is something, you know, important to consider, to say the least, as part of doing such work.
Yeah, the teaching definitely plays a significant role in his characterization of the systems. He also talks about, I guess in the German system, there's that broader idea of hierarchicality, not just in, as you put it, Pedro, the star system, but also in the teaching terms. He gives the example of how a full professor could probably teach Goethe while the lecturer has to teach. And he mentions an author named Ludwig Uhland, saying that you can't even teach the cool classes or the deeper philosophers or the deeper literary artists. You have to start with the kind of small fry in Germany. He is explicit about the privilege concept. So he contrasts the bureaucratic system of the US to a plutocratic system or condition in Germany. Plutocratic is the word he uses, where the idea is that you need to be basically rich enough or from a certain privileged class to be able to live like that, where you're not so desperate about your basic means for survival. The other thing he does point out, though, is that on the flip side, there's more precarity in the American system. And this is even back then. He talks about how in the German system, in my translation, the phrase is, the lecturer has the understandable expectation that if he has worked for years on end, he has a kind of moral claim to consideration. So if you're not going to be kind of kicked out at the same time either. So you're not earning a salary. It's financially non-lucrative, but existentially a bit more stable. Whereas in the US system, it was financially more lucrative, but existentially more precarious, which is, of course, something we see as a product of capitalism in general. So it makes sense. But he points that out as well, which I found interesting. The other thing I found most interesting, and this is what you were saying, Pedro, is that actually we still see some of these differences in the US and German systems, the kind of the chair concept in Germany. You know, in this speech, at one point, Weber says, and I quote, "Our German university life is becoming Americanized in very important respects, as is German life in general." So if someone back in 1917 was proclaiming our system is becoming Americanized, almost 110 years later, the fact that there are still differences actually made me more curious about kind of institutional persistence rather than institutional isomorphism towards one global system. My guess is Weber would not have predicted that there are still differences 110 years later.
Now, let me ask a question, because you've both used a term that I'm not familiar with, the star system. What is that?
So I took it as just not a technical term, but Pedro was just talking about how you've got the star professor on top and everyone is trying to get that. And it's quite exclusionary in some sense, and it's hard to replace the person. So not a technical system description. The only technical word I do see Weber use is plutocratic, like I mentioned.
Okay, no, that, I appreciate that, because I think there is still some form of that. It's just how do we pick the stars might have changed over the course of time. Like how does one earn the right to be all that, you know, or have that level of status and prestige has changed. Which gets into one thing that, you know, we mentioned chance and the factor of chance in weighing one's early progression in academia. I also found it interesting. I marked the word, you know, what is merit? Like, you know, several different places within here, there's kind of like questions that he's asking that get to, okay, how do you actually objectively compare the contributions of one professor from another? It's extremely difficult to observe. Chance plays into it so much because the circumstances may very well be that a contribution is visible from one, but not of the other. And it's kind of fuzzy. Yeah.
So just one quick bit, Tom, before I take the topic further on chance, which to me was my favorite part of this. Let's call the first half of the lecture the external conditions section there, his reliance on his emphasis on chance was a very interesting read. But just before that, as he's concluding this US-Germany comparison, I pointed out, because it speaks to his broader writings and themes on kind of capitalism versus other systems, but he says the technical advantages of the US system are beyond doubt. And it's a bit murky what he means by technical advantages, but let's assume he means just producing more scientific knowledge. But he says that the spirit is lost, or like this, there's a different spirit in that kind of system versus in the German system. And then he has a little throwaway sentence where he says this point about spirit applies also to their inner attitude. So like you as a scientist also naturally, because your incentives are different and the systems are different, it changes your view from this kind of, he talks about himself as a more artisanal old style professor who still owns the means of his production, which in his case is just a library, versus what's happening in the US. And so along with the, let's say, the material conditions of pay, etc., there's also a change in the spirit of what it means to do science. Unfortunately, he doesn't delve into it further, but he does then jump onto the fascinating bit about how much of it is luck. And one of my favorite quotes from this lecture is where he says, "I know of scarcely any other profession on earth where it plays such a crucial role," it referring to luck and chance.
So what is luck? I don't know what luck is in general, but certainly my reading of this text is that residual category for all of the underbelly of the system, right? Because one of the things that is coming across as well is, besides the plutocracy, and I think here it probably would apply for both systems, is the way in which academia works in a patronage way, right? Because certainly, as Tom was saying, it's hard to assess merit and all of these problems of how the incommensurability of different contributions, because people write on different topics, even if they write the same topics, it can be hard to assess. I think that, of course, we exercise as scholars peer review, and that can be applied to comparing different profiles. But what I think what implicit he's getting at, and he's attributing to external forces, but kind of, you know, in a way, weirdly, even though, you know, Weber is known as putting social action as central for structure, he's in a way, maybe because he's giving a lecture and it's hard to say to your peers, pointing to the fact that the choices that are made can be penetrated by all sorts of politics, favor, and all of those things. I think that's also indirectly what he's saying when he's talking about that in America is a bureaucracy, because maybe some of the career paths and expectations may be clearer. I don't know, doesn't strike relation. But certainly, it's interesting that he himself at some point talks about his experience with his own students. And going back to what Raheem said, that there was this idea that in many schools, basically, you would stay, apparently, in the school that you had done your PhD until the habilitation, right? The habilitation, which is this moment, which still exists today in some systems, in which it's almost like a second thesis, right? That, you know, gives you the credential to become what we call today a full professor. And he says, well, I always encourage my students to leave and go to other places, but then people think that I have a problem with them when it's not, right? But I think he's hinting at this idea of affiliation, trading favors, and all of those things with luck. Of course, there's always chance in life, but I think there is also a lot of other more mundane social processes that are happening here.
Yeah, I was going to say that I think in our translation, Girth and Mill's translation, they use the word chance, which I think was much more aligned with what you were talking about, Pedro, of chance associated with one's circumstances, one's place in society going into the field, things that basically detract from an objective comparison of one's accomplishments against another's, where, you know, somebody may be in a privileged position or based on circumstances that are beyond anyone's control, one's work garners more attention than something else. And I also highlighted or noted that particular example of the poor soul cast off, that he's thinking he's doing his protege a favor when he's actually hurting them. And the chance being, you know, the attitude towards decisions made across universities or across different settings that could be misinterpreted. It resonated because we do talk on the military side with Clausewitz, and Clausewitz's treatment of chance is actually a very significant part of his work. that so many things that happen in certain political activities, the outcome is determined not just by the merits of what actions are taken, but also just by luck slash the circumstances at the time, which could be very, very unique to that moment in time.
Yeah, my translation also kind of emphasizes that word chance. And I think, Pedro, you put it beautifully where you said it in Weber's usage in this speech. Chance does seem to be like a residual category. A lot of things come under it, but residual from the kind of social processes and unintentional consequences of the social processes. That the example that both you, Pedro, and Tom picked up on, which is Max Weber's own student, also shows the other side, shows kind of what Weber's idea of the ideal kind of sciences, where the reason he's sending the student to a different sending the student out of his institution is to legitimate the student's kind of scientific caliber. And it's about, you know, you are your own scholar now and go out and do things. But then these social processes affect the outcomes, the more material career outcomes for people. In this section, I noted kind of two elements of this, let's say this residual category or chance. One is he compares becoming a professor in Germany to papal elections, so becoming the Pope, and US presidential elections, so becoming the president of the US. And in both cases, he talks about how it's not always the best candidate for the job who wins. It's often the second or third best. He doesn't delve into the mechanisms of, you know, what it is about collective decision-making processes that gives rise to this phenomenon. But that's one thing he brings up when he talks about kind of academic life being, in his words, an utter gamble. And then the second thing that I kind of noted was when he talks about teaching, because he talks about how to be a good professor, you have to be both a good teacher and a good scholar. And these aren't necessarily a given that you'll be good at both. And he gives some examples of German scholars who are not good teachers. And implicit in all of this is he does seem to take someone's abilities or talent as kind of inborn and given. So there's a bit of this kind of fixed mindset in today's language, we would call it, about him. And he uses the phrase, the art of teaching is a personal gift. And so to him, that's a matter of chance. Like, you could be a very good scholar, but you just don't have that personal gift of teaching. And that is your lack of chance, your misfortune, your bad luck that gets in the way of you becoming a professor, especially because, as he notes, there's a move towards more and more volumes. So the more students you can attract, the better these universities treat you.
So after this very discouraging set of reflections, he's not done, right? Because he's going to go into what the reading is most known for, which is exactly the idea of vocation, the characteristics of science, what it means to exercise this job or this work or this profession. And he starts by covering some of the characteristics of science first, right? That he talks about how it is increasingly specialized, on how, I think it has this interesting turn of phrase, that talks about how it demands both passion and discipline, and the characteristic that science is some kind of, by default, provisional. So we have expected always to be superseded. There are more, but I think that this is things enough for us to start. What kind of work one can expect to do, and how one needs to adjust one expectations, visions, right, to this idea to, I think he says it, you know, learning to put blinders in your focus, right, because of specialization, in trying to think about attributing so much external forces, but seeing both as dedication, and the outputs come from that, from this deep engagement, and how accepting this fate that, unlike an artist, he makes some parallels to art, it's not that the output is ever finished, right, and is eternal, but the whole idea is that, you know, science always generates more questions, and it's meant to be superseded, and has, of course, this is, of course, related to our own idea about knowledge that we can get into later that he also brings. But I think there is also, I think, another set, if you want, of advice or reflections about what it means to do this work, right, at this point in time, in this place.
Yeah, so I do want to draw out one more negative quote from his external conditions, again, for purely entertainment value. This happens just at the end before he moves to the internal conditions for vocation. He says, "I at least have found only a handful of people who have survived this process, i.e. the process of kind of becoming a professor, without injury to their personality." So I don't know if it relates, but we might have come across senior academics who've had to perhaps compromise aspects of personality to get to what it takes to be elite. Now, yeah, I'm happy to go sequentially in some of these main topics. So the first one he moves to when he talks about inner vocation is, like you said, Pedro, about specialization. And he kind of makes this sweeping statement about how science has entered the stage of specialization that, in his words, has no precedent and that will continue for all time. And it seems to be true 110 years later that it continues specialization. But what to him, what that means is that hence, if you are a scientist and that's your vocation, you need to, like you said, Pedro, have blinders on. And he uses this phrase that you have to kind of convince yourself that the destiny of your soul lies in this one conjecture that you're trying to make in this one paper. What he's effectively trying to say is, which is something we grapple with today as well, is like you shouldn't start thinking about, okay, what does this actually do? What is the broader impact? Is this going across? Am I speaking to multiple audiences? You shouldn't be thinking that much about breadth and kind of reach and scope. And you should be someone for whom you are deeply obsessed with and you find meaning, again, at the level of the soul from whatever next claim you are making in your specific field that you're working in. And for him, that's kind of a quality he does now at this point of the lecture does seem to move towards more of his beliefs. So let's say if the first part of the lecture was him almost a bit lamenting and a bit satirically noting just the way things are, here there's a bit more of the way things should be. So he does seem to agree that you should have that kind of passion if you are to be a scientist. He then moves from passion to inspiration, but I'll leave that for one of y'all to pick up.
Yeah, that was exactly what I was going to get into, is that it wasn't just the importance of the passion, but it's also he was getting a sense from the younger academics coming in that they were yearning for this sense of passion, that science had become too, I guess, rigid or impersonal, or that these younger people were looking for meaning in the scientific work. I did note that he begins that part of the passage about a comparison between the ancient biological man and the more modern civilized man, in which the sense of progress as some sort of a continuum of growth of knowledge and specialization and all that was something that's fairly recent. It was not in existence prior to the modern era. He makes that assertion. But then from there, okay, progress towards what? And he spent quite a bit of time the version I'm looking at is about 3 pages worth of text that I scrawled a lot of notes on. It's not just that the younger academics were looking for a restoration of some sort of like a sense of wonder to fuel their passion. It is also the general question of what things that science solves versus what they don't solve. And a lot of that which science is not really equipped to answer falls into those very same categories of what people, you know, how people should live their lives on the basis of what's been found in scientific progress. And in this essence, squaring the sense of intellectual growth against the same sense of wonder or the sense of existential understanding. He even went to the point of going through science by science or academic field by academic field to talk about what it is that they do or don't answer, such as in the field of medicine, you could create a new procedure or you could create a new drug or you could create some new treatment. But then the question is whether or not you should actually apply the treatment. What are the risks? What is the second order effects? What may be the social unacceptability of that particular medical procedure that would say that we shouldn't be doing this? We can come up with specific contemporary examples later, but he's basically going through field by field asking that question. Just because you can make a piece of art doesn't mean that that piece of art is worth making, or is it something that's going to be offensive to other people, and so on.
Yeah, I had this a little bit later because I think that's also one of the points that's well known on the lecture, right? Of course, texts get read in many ways, and I think that's one of the things that has stayed for posterity for sure, given all of the work of Weber on values and rationalization and so on, which is this idea that science cannot answer itself fundamental questions of life, right? This is beyond the scope. And in a way, he has this whole idea on how it has to be more or less value-free. And therefore, itself responds to the question, what to do with this, right? Whether and why such idea is relevant, but rather is a process of how. So it's like, it's a space that it is beyond scope, and the very tools of science cannot answer that. And he talks about that on how, you know, this is basically like the job for philosophy of those areas, not of the people that are, you know, being part of this trajectory, right? This kind of work, this joint enterprise into that.
I found that this part to be quite illuminating and almost philosophical, where he goes into how even the products of science, it's not necessarily something that increases even our understanding of the world. He uses kind of the term savages to refer to, I guess, what we would today call, I don't know, Eastern or Global South and other populations. But his point is this, quote unquote, the savage knows his actual tools and his kind of the conditions he lives in much more than someone in Munich who probably uses, you know, a vehicle or a car without knowing anything about how it works, or eats food without knowing anything about how the food got to their plate. So scientific progress isn't so much about greater understanding at the individual level. It's more about this kind of attitude of, I could know if I wanted to, because the knowledge is there to be known. And so he also ties it in with his broader theme of disenchantment that comes from this kind of rationalization and what he calls the intellectualization of the world. And so he moves from this idea that, yes, these bigger questions of what should we do, how should we live, cannot be answered by science. And the question that science can answer, he says, is what should we do if we wish to make use of technology to control life? So that's the question science answers, is that, okay, if we want to use technology to control life, what do we do? What's next? And without, you know, leaving completely unanswered, is that even a good thing? Do we want to control life? Do we want to use technology to control life? It is either, you know, neglected or taken to be presumed as, yes, we want this. And so now science helps us answer this question. So he very neatly separates out kind of science understanding a life well lived, and then what is the actual scope of science? And the actual scope is this kind of instrumental control over our world using technology. Again, and which we see in today's world, the more control we have, we almost understand it less because the systems are more and more complex. But the control, sure, is increasing as technology progresses.
Yes, and I think it's important to tie this up, as he does, and bring, because of course, you know, this is Weber at his core. As you were saying, rationalization, this is enchantment on how people become, you know, in his understanding, to do this work, you're going to be a vehicle for this, right? So that was going to happen. And he does, of course, in a Weberian style, refer to other eras and moments in which science, the pursuit of science, was seen as a mean to achieve, you know, some kind of revelations, right? Some kind, and he compares that with how it was connected to even religiosity or art, because it was seen as being closer to nature and understanding, you know, revealing some things and so on, versus this more progress, right? And rationalization, which basically understanding the basic operations of how things work, that the kind of modern science is trying to achieve. But there is also a social context in which the kind of science that he's talking about has come to be, which he contrasts with different moments. But I think what is important here is also two things. One is that we have been talking about the external conditions and the internal, but in a way at this point, I think is, and with the idea of vocation, he's trying to link them. That exactly he is, has this almost like normative, surprisingly, given he has this whole thing about value-free science, but his position in his reading about what science is, which is also close to what it should be, right, the way he writes, is to be and embody that forward, right? To be a scientist that conforms to that. And the career of the individual then links with the more historical processes by which those understandings, values, assumptions, ideologies of what science is are carried forward, right? So I think it's an important thing to highlight that in the description he's making, he's also making it to, and showing how the person, by behaving in such a way and in, you know, understanding the job in such a way and performing in such a way, then contributes for this system to, you know, exists and endures and so on.
I just want to circle back to one thing Tom had said as well. So I think what Weber does in sequence is he sets up this idea of science being more about progress. And then he also ties it in with how that then creates that problem of meaning. And then he suggests perhaps the solution is that you just want to contribute to progress. But to better understand it, the problem itself, I felt, was also very kind of well put, where he talks about, you know, the Tom referred to the phrase, the civilized man, and how their life is kind of meaningless because progress is endless and the scientific project is an infinite one. And he uses the word infinity in there as well. And the idea is that back in the day when life was seen as more cyclical, kind of things repeat in older traditions, you could die, in his phrase, old and fulfilled by life. But when you know that whatever you do, whatever project you're working on, it's endless, you'll always die with the job unfulfilled, unfinished, because there's always more that can happen. It's part of a long kind of, again, infinite sequence. Then that takes that level of fulfillment out of it. And so he, again, I quote him, he says, "A civilized man, however, who is inserted into a never-ending process by which civilization is enriched with ideas, knowledge, and problems, may become tired of life, but not fulfilled by it." I found that super interesting because it's the idea, his kind of almost prediction is that modern people will die of, you know, tiredness rather than fulfillment, because the work never ends. You could, whether it's you're working on social progress or scientific advance or political change or what have you, it's a never-ending process in Weber's conceptualization. And then that brings us back to kind of what Pedro was saying, that Weber then sees the vocation of science as being put your head down, work, and contribute to this thing. Again, we go back to, you know, it's specialized work. It's he then moves on. We can discuss that about the valuelessness of it or the value-freeness of it. And then just, you know, he doesn't say it in a bad way, but it's almost like he's saying, you should be just a quiet, diligent cog in the enterprise or in the machine.
I would say that, by the way, in the translation that I read, the term was may become tired of life, but not satiated with life. I don't know that necessarily changes the meaning, but I actually struggle with that part a little bit. I understand where he's coming from, but there is also kind of a sense that in the biological sphere, we kind of understood that when it was our time to go, that we were handing things off to the next generation, and it was familial. Whereas nowadays, or I should say at this time, it was shifting, like, you know, who are you leaving this next set of progress to? And that's the next generation of academics, who is not familial necessarily, but it's still a handing process. Maybe from Weber's perspective, that was not as satisfying, but I'm not so sure that that was universally true.
So this is my understanding from broader kind of readings. So I'm going beyond Weber's text here, but I think the idea is that the handoffs in the, let's say, the traditional way of life versus the more rational, intellectual, scientific way of life. In the traditional way of life, the handoffs are still to another generation that will experience the same cycle that you did. So you know, you grew up, you were an apprentice, you became a master, or you took over the farm, you had kids, you had grandkids, you fulfilled your duties, you hand it over. The other people are going to do the exact same. So you're not kind of missing out on any experience. You've done your part on this kind of, you know, stage of life, and they're going to go, other people are going to go and say the same dialogues, play out the same script on the stage of life. Versus now it's kind of if I'm very passionate about my research or as kind of scientific methods, I might have made a lot of progress, but let's say I'm an AI researcher, I died just before AGI, and I wish I could have played with those bigger tools and had those new experiences. Or back to the familial thing, you know, I might hand off to the next generation, but the next generation might go and, you know, live in Argentina or experience something totally different. And again, I never got to play out those scripts on the stage of life or say those dialogues. But then at the same time, that is never ending, whether it's accumulation of experience or of progress or of getting to play with new technology or seeing growth, seeing us become a multiplanetary species, whatever it may be. In the past, you were handing it off to someone who will then go through the same cycle, and hence the word satiation is perhaps even better, because it just means like, yeah, you're done. You've experienced all there is to experience from this life, and you're ready to kind of let go.
I mean, this is the whole story of modernity, right? To always want more. And we can bring this, I think, and expand and talk about this more in the next section about this whole growth idea that he's coupled with modernity, which of course we understand. But also we know the downsides nowadays. But I think the other point that I wanted to bring up that's in the text, I think, towards the end, is what it means to be a teacher, right? Because it talks about the sense of what is this ethos I'm going to use of being a scientist and accepting this and what kind of life you can expect. But also he talks about here, and that here there's a connection with his previous writings and some of the stuff that we covered here, about almost like being a teacher in particular as being in a so-called office or a sphere of obligation in a role. You know, many ways we can use to talk about this, but basically being fulfilling a particular duty in a professional role in this organization, which it can be an university and or another higher education and institute. And he does a lot of stuff, again, continue with the idea that maybe in the macro is that science cannot answer itself the values for its existence, right? It's beyond the scope. But also the teachers should avoid preaching personal politics and morality and so on. He also makes an interesting comparison between a teacher and a leader, right? Which again, if you read, having read the broader Weber, it's almost that, you know, a sense of what a bureaucrat can do or anyone that is in a particular role and the limits and responsibilities that one has and how one has to not just structurally, but also subjectively exercise his ability to try as much as possible to be value neutral and trying to avoid conversation a certain way, and especially not using the role for communicating a particular message. And he's interesting because he talks about that the condition and probably how lectures would happen, that most of the audience would be silent. So he says, you know, especially if you are given the mic, we would say today, you have the responsibility of what you're going to impart to the people listening to you. But of course, if you're on a square that people can talk back and debate, that's all different, right? It is also not exercising. You're not in an official capacity there. He goes at very great lengths to establish, right, that. And I think that is interesting, knowing that we know about, you know, what has written about bureaucracies and roles and limits and what it means to work in such a system, because it's, I think, implicit here as well.
Yeah, I'll save a commentary about this part for part two. But, you know, in terms of what it is that he's presenting, just, you know, just reading the text here, I did find it interesting to think about, okay, value neutral. There's two different ways of thinking about value neutral. One of them is to extract or separate the values from the information. And the other is to be balanced and present both sides, if you will. And it struck me as he's taking the former stance, of which very specifically says that the role of the prophet and the role of the demagogue is not the role of the lecturer or the role of the teacher. I'll save my opinion about that for the next part, but it was a part that I took very I made a lot of notes on it. Because it is interesting from a scientific perspective, I can understand where he's coming from. Because I know, like, for example, with the depictions of capitalism, usually unflattering depictions of capitalism at the time, the roles of the military, the roles of the clergy, the roles of all of the institutions that imparted values or impart or presented a sense of ethics and whatever were seen as solely in support of the political position. And so to Weber, it was like, for example, the way in which the clergy are typically depicted is the phrase, we fool you. You know, we fool you, the military, we shoot you. And the king and the monarchy was, we rule you. It's very, very simple like that, showing how the attitudes towards capitalism were persisted. And this is, to me, what I first came to mind when I started reading this passage about why he's taking those types of perspectives off the table and saying, don't talk about politics, don't talk about demagoguery, focus on the facts, focus on what the science tells you, and don't wander into these other areas. Now, I don't know if that's necessarily what inspired him there, but that was what I was thinking of as I read this part.
Yeah, and perhaps before, I too had a lot of thoughts about that, and we can definitely discuss those in part two, because I think some of the underlying assumptions of what the classroom looked like at the time also no longer hold true. And so maybe even he would have different recommendations for a lecturer today, but we can discuss that in a bit. One thing I just want to make sure we touch upon in this, under this internal conditions, is for a very brief moment, he revisits that concept of chance again here. And that's in the form of getting inspiration. So this is before he talks about the problem of meaning in science and how you need to, this endless progress and what we've just been discussing now in terms of being value-free in your teaching and lecturing. And this is just after he talks about how you need to be passionate and kind of obsessed and dedicated and specialized. He also says science needs, he calls it, quote unquote, the decisive factor in my translation, and namely inspiration. So his point is, you can have all the tools, you can do all the math, crunch all the data. He uses the phrase statistical cards. And so you can work through everything, but at some point, something has to occur to you. And I liked that wording, like something has to occur to you for it to be kind of, you as a scientist are in it then, because the inspiration comes from you and through you. At the same time, because Weber does seem to, you know, for lack of a better phrase, have this fixed mindset view of your kind of these things, you can't control these things. So for him, that inspiration is also an element of chance. And so he says, and I quote, the scholar must resign himself to the element of chance that is involved in every kind of scientific endeavor. It is expressed in the question, will inspiration come or not? And so just the way in the early time, in part one, he talks about chance in terms of the social processes and evaluation and promotion, and then chance in terms of what culture you're born into, what ethnicity and so on, and in terms of how good a teacher you are. Here he brings in one more element, which is chance in terms of whether inspiration strikes. And so his image seems to be, you can have two people working on the same project or data or analyzing the same thing, but one is struck with inspiration, whereas the other is not. And that flips their outcomes in terms of what they get out of it as scientists as well.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated, as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.